This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. It's better over
here. AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Joining us is Mike Petrelli, president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and visiting fellow from the Hoover Institution, about a recent longitudinal study that was released looking at the link between race, socioeconomic status, and achievement gaps in school. Mike wrote the foreword to this report by the Thomas B. Fordham Group, comparing the results of a study 20 years ago to a study most recently released. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Mike, I think I got that right. I'm not sure, but there's a lot of information in this, report.
You said it well. You said it very well. Yes.
So obviously 20 years ago, back in 2004, you talk about these economists, Roland Fryer and Stephen Levitt, publishing a seminal paper on understanding the black-white test score gap in the first 2 years of school. And then you guys were curious about where do we stand today, looking back at what the findings were there. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, this paper has largely been forgotten, and it shouldn't be because it's super important and interesting, has a lot of relevance to all the debates we have, not just about education, but about race in America and the challenge of closing gaps, the critical race theory debate, everything. That paper 20 years ago, what it found is that if you control for just a small number of variables, you could basically close the racial achievement gap. The test score gap that kids have that we see when they enter school. And that gap is enormous. I mean, we've known forever that white and Asian students on one hand are outscoring black and Hispanic students on the other and by wide margins. And that's not something you just see after kids have been in school a long time. You see it when they enter school. So you can interpret then that it has a lot to do with what happens to kids before they get to school in those 0 to 5 years. What Fryer and Levitt were able to do is they said, look, if you control for some things, including household income, the mother's education level, a few other variables related to that socioeconomic status, but also some health things, things like was your mom a teenage mother? What was your birth weight, which is an indication of whether maybe you were getting what you needed when you were prenatal? You control for all those things, and you can make the racial achievement gap disappear. And what that means to me is that when we're looking at these gaps, it's really not about race. You know, we see it because we see race, but it's really about the underlying socioeconomic conditions. Now, it's still tragic. I mean, especially when you look at the black-white gap, we know that black children growing up in America are still dramatically more likely to be growing up in poverty, growing up in persistent poverty, growing up in single-parent homes, growing up in homes that have things like lead paint that hurts their development, you know, being born with low birth weight because they're not getting, their mothers aren't getting what they need before they're born. So all of that But that is why we're seeing these achievement gaps. It really has nothing to do with race per se. It has to do with poverty and socioeconomic status and all the rest. That's when kids enter school. However, once they start moving their way through school, through elementary school, we actually see the black-white gap get larger. We found that 20 years ago, and sadly, we still find that today. And that may be one of the most important findings. What that means is that our schools, instead of narrowing achievement gaps, are actually widening them. And that is likely because black students continue to have less access to good schools than white students, even white kids with the very same, say, income or mother's education level. There's still a great amount of inequality. Frankly put, we're still struggling to provide great schools to a lot of poor black students across the country.
Mike, what struck me is if we know that they're coming in the entry level behind in reading, and reading is, you know, the foundation for everything. I mean, it's hard to understand math. It's hard to understand science if you don't master reading. And I've asked this of our education secretary in the state of Louisiana. Why don't, and we know that the public school system, at least in state, is where the lion's share of those that fall low on the scale of that socioeconomic status, why would we not alter the manner in which we are presenting material and just spend more time early onset on reading and writing and forget about some of those other things early onset? Because I'm told that folks can catch up when they've mastered, or not mastered, but they've improved their reading capabilities and their writing capabilities, and a lot of it they can catch up later, like spelling. I mean, you know, we come in and we're doing flashcards of spelling. It's like, what the hell? You can pick that up in the fourth grade or fifth grade and just do it phonetically. Who cares if you have the A in the right place, you know, early onset?
Yes and no, Newell. I mean, I understand the impulse, but you got to be careful with a few things. And that's because we know when it comes to reading, other than learning how to decode the language, which is essential, it's that first step. How do you sound out those letters into a word? The reason a lot of kids are struggling with reading is they have very limited vocabularies. So they sound out Tyrannosaurus Rex, but they've never heard about that because they've never, you know, been read to about dinosaurs or seen. So what you don't want to do is have a system where you save things like science and history until later, because it's actually the case that the earlier we teach things like science and history, I mean, the basics for 5, 6, 7-year-olds, the bigger their vocabularies get, the better their reading comprehension is. So you just got to make sure that you see that kind of teaching and that kind of content as part of teaching reading. Now, can you wait on some of the other stuff? Sure. It's also, we have found that some kids just need more time. And that's why you see some of these policies in states around the country where there's some kind of third grade reading guarantee that says, hey, if you get to the third grade, you're still not, you haven't learned to master, especially fluently reading, decoding, then let's give the kid an extra year and extra tutoring, extra supports until they master it. Don't push them through and push them along because they'll never catch up. And they're just going to fall further and further behind.
I think parents are a lot to blame. I mean, I remember going through that, you know, that choice. And there's a stigma, right, when you start with your group of kids and you're working your way through school and you get to a certain point and, you know, you have to make this decision and you're wondering whether or not it's the right thing because of the stigma for the child socially and otherwise. And sometimes I think we put too much pressure on our kids socially in that respect. And we ought to just, like you just said, sit back a year. You got, you know, 1 year is not going to kill you in your educational, you know, journey.
Yeah. I mean, we did this with my youngest son when he was 5 years old and we were trying to decide whether to send him to kindergarten. And like a lot of parents, and frankly, a lot of upper middle class parents, we decided to, quote, redshirt him for a year. Now that's happening with a lot of boys. And you can understand why, you know, he still wasn't super mature. He was having some issues in his preschool. We said, let's give him another year and he's doing great. you know, it's really a hard issue to study, you know, because the kids that end up getting redshirted, you know, might have other stuff going on. But it seems to be fine. You know, we've heard some people have been out there saying we should do that for all boys. I don't know about all boys, but I think what we should do is we should be willing to give kids who need it that extra year, do it, you know, delay the entry to kindergarten, or just, you know, add another grade to elementary school if you need to. You know, I would think in New Orleans, you could say every elementary school in New Orleans, instead of, you know, it goes from kindergarten to fifth grade, add an extra year in there so that they have more time. What does it matter? Okay, all those kids will end up graduating high school at 19 instead of 18. Fine. You've given them an extra year, though, to master this stuff so that when they get to middle school, they're ready to hit the ground running. When they get to high school, they're ready to succeed in those tougher courses. Instead, we play this catch-up game all the way through.
I read the report, Mike, last night after I watched, you know, all the speeches at the DNC. And right away, I was like on page 4 or 5, and I recognized, you know, I didn't hear much talk about education at either convention, mm-hmm. quite frankly. And it kind of mystifies me. And I don't know if this is just too complex or what it is, but this is where a lot of our primary focus ought to be, right? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. and it may not be that it's going to take a lot of extra dollars. It may just be we need to put the dollars in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case?
I agree
or not?
With you, and it's really depressing. You know, there was a time, I remember the 2000 campaign, you know, between George W. Bush and Gore. They had a debate, and I'm spending something like 10 minutes talking about education. It was a big focus of both conventions that year. Hardly anything this year. You know, the Democrats don't want to do anything to make the teachers' unions mad. In fact, both union presidents had marquee speaking slots last night. The Republicans are just talking about throwing money at parents, you know, with these education savings accounts, which, hey, I'm for school choice, but we got to worry about whether or not kids are, you know, learning, whether parents are using that money well. So the Democrats want to throw the money at the public schools and the Republicans want to throw the money at the parents. Meanwhile, nobody is talking about accountability, improving teaching, improving the way we do reading. So, yeah, it's depressing. And I am hopeful that we can get back to the point where we put these issues at the top of the agenda again. Now, there's still some governors out there, state lawmakers, that are making these issues important. But at the national level, it's just zip.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go 5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, 3-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, it's one of the reasons I focus on poverty, because this really embraced kind of my thought about, you know, fighting poverty. We have almost 40 million, I think we're about 41 million now, living below the federally identified poverty level in this country, right? And with population migration and what's going on not only here within the states, but also what's going on with countries coming to this state, that problem is growing exponentially, but we don't have a response to it. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, I don't see any connection between something that we are really, on the leading edge of doing, addressing what is identified in this report to close that gap. Mm-hmm. Do you?
You know, the only thing, well, look, the one thing I would point to is you do have both parties talking about some kind of expanded child tax credit. You know, J.D. Right. Vance, at least, was talking about a $5,000 tax credit. Kamala Harris said, okay, I'll see you and raise you $1,000 on that, at least for infants. And look, it's expensive, especially if you provide it to everybody. But it would make a difference on child poverty. We tried that during the pandemic. It did have a big impact. You know, of course it has an impact. You're just, you know, it's automatic. You give people money, they're not as poor. And according to this study, household income, it matters. So, you know, that is something you can do. These other issues, though, are much harder. I mean, of course, one of the biggest issues is family structure. You've got kids growing up in single parent households. You know, not only does the single mom, it's usually the mom, right, have to try to make a living plus provide care for the kids. It's super. I can't imagine how hard that is, right? But she's only making one income. And so, not surprisingly, a lot of those households are below the poverty line. You've got two parent families, and they can provide both more support and parenting, but also more money. And solving that problem, it's hard. You know, we at least don't see it getting worse anymore, at least by most counts, but it isn't getting much better either. And that's even though we've had this huge decline in teenage births. We still see a lot of kids growing up in these broken families. So that's a tough one. It's a hard one for politics to fix. I think that's something that's got to come from some real cultural change.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, just so for the benefit of the listening audience, the stats, 58% of black students live in poverty. 56% of Hispanic students come. These are from the bottom three income categories, as reported in, as placed in your report, mm-hmm. and only one in five students, 19%, and 24% of Asian students. And then y'all make the correlation of Asians and whites and how they outperform, and you know, as it relate, or they're the ones that are widening that gap, and you know, again. I don't see this connection. Part of the problem, I guess, with the child tax credit, there's no guarantee that it's actually going to be spent on the things that you need to spend on your kids directly to really mm-hmm. make that difference. Mm-hmm. You know, reading to your kids, buying books for your kids, or any of those things, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. Now, I think there was some evidence from the pandemic that the extra money that went to poor families back then, that they did spend it on things that you'd want them spending it on, including some of those things for their kids directly or for food. But that's part of the debate we should have. You know, are we better off just trying to give people tax relief, support, you know, people who are working these low-wage jobs, give them some income support, let them decide how to use it, or should we do, you know, more food stamps? And maybe this education stuff, we should have some kind of tax credit or voucher for enrichment activities, so you can have your kid go to tutoring after school or sign up for the local soccer team. I mean, these are things we should talk about. I guess it depends, you know, how much you want to lean into trusting parents and families to make their own decisions on these things versus making sure the money actually goes to the kids.
I was also surprised by the gap between two-parent households and one-parent household by race. 93% mm-hmm. of Asian students, 86% of white students live in two-parent households, only 48% of black students, and let's see, I think Hispanic students were, I lost the figure.
Maybe 75%, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, 79%. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 79%. You know, I had no idea that the gap was that large. From black to Asians, whites, and Hispanics.
Oh, it's enormous, and you know, it helps to explain some of the things that we're seeing. Oh, I still got some new one.
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it helps to explain some of these things that we're seeing because, look, you've got, you know, we say, okay, why is it that the black-white gap might be growing, but the white-Hispanic gap is not? And one of those reasons may be that because, you know, so many more Hispanic kids are growing up in two-parent families. So you know, that's another form of disadvantage that black kids are dealing with. That's just so much greater. You know, my own sense is that the Hispanic kids, by and large, are doing okay, and they're going to be okay. You know, as their families are here generation over generation, they look more and more like other Americans. You know, my Italian ancestors, it took them a few generations, but, you know, now our family's doing great. You know, that's going to happen with Hispanic families as well. You know, the progress has been much slower, unfortunately, for black children. And you got to point to the black family as one part of that. We have just got to figure out how to have some real cultural change so that that fewer kids have to grow up with just one parent.
It was interesting, too, how this most recent study really kind of embraced a lot of the outcomes of that study 20 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it really has not changed much at all, you know, and that's sobering. I mean, look, the study 20 years ago, there had been some good news at the time, which was that that the achievement gaps had closed somewhat, some of the opportunity gaps had closed, that the 1990s were a really good time in terms of reducing child poverty, especially for black children. That was showing up. But we haven't made as much progress since then, and especially in the 2010s. And then, of course, the pandemic has just been a complete disaster. So we've got work to do. You know, I mean, I think the message has got to be that progress is possible. We have made progress at times in this country in driving down child poverty and in narrowing these achievement gaps. But we got to get back to the things that work.
Yeah, it's got to be and again, going back to, we're just not on the national level. We're not talking about it. You know, we have one party wants to get rid of the Department of Education, another one that's pushing back on it, but not anybody really talking about real solutions here, right? I mean, it's just kind of frustrating. And, you know,
That's right.
I guess one has to ask, and I'm going to have you back on. What role does the, because we run out of time, but I'm going to try and get you back on next week. And I want to talk about what role does the DOE actually play? And are we getting a return on that investment? And what is it that they're doing? I think it's a conversation we ought to have. Because, you know, interestingly, mainstream media is not asking these candidates about it. And, you know, they're not even talking about it. It'd be interesting to hear your take on that. So we'll contact you, and hopefully you'll be available for us next week. Mike Petrelli, it's always a pleasure to have you. Always a pleasure to have you on. President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and visiting fellow for the Hoover Institution. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me on.
All righty, we'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get 4 5G phones on us and 4 lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, 3-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.